Oh, that is such a good, transparent, vulnerable story. I'm so grateful for it. And it is going to tie directly into what we talk about today. As we wrap up our series called This Earthen Vessel, we've been building a theology of the human body almost literally from the ground up. I mean, we were formed out of the dust of the earth, and we started in week one, almost 2 months ago, talking about the fact that these bodies are created. They are fearfully and wonderfully made. And we talked about the fact that our bodies are gendered. We were created male and female in the image and likeness of God. And these bodies are sexual bodies, and they're redeemed bodies, redeemed by the blood of Christ. They're to be disciplined. They suffer. They're social bodies. They are made to relate and interact with each other. And today, we kind of come to the pinnacle. We're going to talk about the worshiping body. There's a worship song that goes, "You and I were made to worship." And that is true, as I hope you'll see as we go. But for starters, I want you to think about maybe you have, I'm sure all of you at some point have been in a stadium. Maybe you've been recently. And, you know, just before kickoff or the first pitch, the stadium announcer comes on and says, "And now, ladies and gentlemen, please rise and direct your attention to the flag beyond the center field wall as we play our national anthem." You've heard that. And sometimes they tell you not only to rise, but they tell you to remove your caps. Sometimes they tell you not just to rise for the playing of the anthem, but they invite you to rise and join in singing the anthem. And I always like to observe people's reactions to this call to worship. You know, it expands a full spectrum. You know, for some people, this thing is a total hassle. Because this fan has just arrived, just squeezed himself into his tiny little seat. He's got that cardboard carrier perched on his knees. He's got a drink, a hot dog dripping mustard, nachos with cheese running over the edge. And he's just gotten himself settled, and now he's being asked to rise in devotion to the flag and the country. And he doesn't feel like it. But he acquiesces and he finds a way to get himself up and to participate. But then on the other end of the spectrum, it goes from kind of total hassle to total honor. There are some people that as soon as the announcer invites them to rise, they don't just rise. They like snap to attention. They don't just remove their caps. They put their hands over their hearts. They don't just gaze off into oblivion while the anthem plays. They join in singing, and they sing lustily. And I wonder sometimes what the backstory is there. You know, I'm just guessing, you know, maybe they served in the military. Maybe they come from a long line of veterans. Maybe they're an immigrant. They weren't born citizens like most of us who could then easily take it for granted. No, they had to work for and earn their citizenship. And they chose to become naturalized citizens of the United States of America. And they live in perpetual gratitude for the fact that here they enjoy peace and freedom. And they have a job and they have a house. And what a contrast to the hardships of their past life. And so to be bidden to rise and sing the national anthem is the least that they can do. And we might wish that our country were such that, you know, everyone was flourishing to such a degree that everyone would gladly participate in a 2-minute anthem. And then you can sit down and eat your hot dog and nachos. But it's not always like that, is it? But how much more, if that's what we would wish for at a national level, how much more would it just seem natural to us that when we're bidden to rise in honor of the God of the universe, who just so happens to also be our daddy, that we would engage heart and soul? And so with that, may I invite you, ladies and gentlemen, in honor of God, and his omnipotent power and amazing grace to invite us to be citizens of the kingdom of heaven, would you rise for the reading of today's scripture? Psalm 95. "Come, let us sing for joy to the Lord. Let us shout aloud to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before him with thanksgiving and extol him with music and song. For the Lord is the great God, the great King above all gods. In his hand are the depths of the earth, and the mountain peaks belong to him. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. Come, let us bow down in worship. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture, the sheep of his hand. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as you did at Meribah, as you did that day at Massah in the wilderness, where your ancestors tested me. They tried me, though they had seen what I did. For 40 years I was angry with that generation. I said, they are a people whose hearts go astray, and they have not known my ways. So I declared on oath in my anger, they shall never enter my rest. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God, and you may be seated. Psalm 95 is a call to worship. In fact, Bible scholars tell us it's not kind of just a call to worship. It is the call to worship. It is, historically speaking, probably the most read, most quoted psalm of them all. Even though we might find Psalm 23 much more beloved, Psalm 95, historians tell us, at least since the 4th century, in some Christian traditions, has been the psalm that is used as a call to worship every single week when the church gathers. And it just invites us again and again and again to come. Come, let us sing. Come, let us shout. Come, let us come before God with thanksgiving. Come, let us kneel. Come, let us bow down. Come to God. And to liken this call to worship to a PA announcer's invitation to stand for the national anthem is actually kind of a little bit weak. We got to ratchet up the analogy a little bit. I mean, when it says, you know, come, let us sing. Well, you might think more of like how the Liverpool crowd sings at Anfield, at their home stadium. They all stand up and they hold up their scarves, which I don't quite, it's soccer. They hold up their scarves and they sing, you'll never walk alone. The whole stadium rocking as they sing this great anthem. When it says, come, let us shout, I think of like Iceland, you know, and their soccer team. And they do this like Viking clap thing where they all start like this, you know, the players and a whole stadium behind them. And it starts real slow, but there's a drum beat. And on the drum beat, everybody claps and goes, whoo, whoo. And then they go again and again and again. It gets faster and faster and faster. And man, I have Irish heritage, but at that moment, I wish so much I was a Viking. It is awesome. When you say kneel, I think of the All Blacks, you know, from New Zealand, who do this thing called the haka, this Maori tribal thing. And part of it is they are kneeling down. And I suppose it shows some kind of reverence or obeisance to, you know, their tradition. But there's also a kind of a power in their kneeling. There's an honor. And that's what this psalm is calling us to. Give full attention and complete devotion to God, to the God whose hands, you know, made the mountains and formed the dry land, and whose very same hands also happen to hold your hand and guide you along like a shepherd leads his sheep. Honor that God. Honor that God who saved you from death, who rescued you from slavery and brought you to freedom, who gave you a hope and a future instead of certain doom, who exchanged your hell for his heaven. Come and honor that God. That's what Psalm 95 is calling you to. That's who you should worship, but what do you actually worship? What do you worship? And I pose it as a question, but there's actually an assertion behind it. You do worship. You worship. The question is what? Like Megan reminded us, you know, we are all first and foremost fundamentally lovers and desirers. With all due respect to Rene Descartes, who was a brilliant philosopher, I think, therefore I am, is wrong. We are not fundamentally thinking beings, though we have rational faculties, and it's a wonderful gift. Beneath our thinking is our feeling. We are desirers. We are lovers. The question is not if you will love, but what you will love. And you could put the word worship in that sentence just as easily. The question is not what will you, if you will worship, but what will you worship? Because love and worship are virtually identical. When you love something, you raise it to the place of supreme value. Whatever you love, you value most. You can like a million things, but you really only love a few things. And the things you love are the things to which you ascribe the most worth, which is exactly what worship is. Worship is worth-ship. It's that to which you ascribe the greatest worth. What is that for you? How many of you read the Harry Potter novels? I can't believe it. The first one was released in the United States 20 years ago this summer. And in that first novel, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, you might remember there's a chapter in there called The Mirror of Erised. The Mirror of Erised. It's the word desire backward. And Harry Potter discovers it one Christmas night. He's received on Christmas Day from some unknown source an invisibility cloak. And he decides that night to try it out. And he's making his way through Hogwarts, and he comes into this room and sees this very tall mirror. And Harry Potter stands in front of it, and all of a sudden he sees in the mirror that he's not alone, and he looks behind him, but there's nobody behind him. But when he looks back into the mirror, he sees about 10 people, and one of them is a red-haired woman who has eyes just like his. And beside her is a tall, kind of gangly, bespectacled guy with a shock of hair sticking up, just like Harry's. And he realizes these are his parents, whom he's never known. They died when he was an infant. And the mirror is showing him his parents. And they're standing there. And his mother's waving at him and crying at the same time. And Harry Potter kind of wants to do the same. He goes back to his room. And the next day he brings his friend Ron Weasley with him. Back to the mirror. He's like, I want you to come. I want you to meet my family. But when Ron stands in front of the mirror, he doesn't see anybody else except himself. But Ron stands in front of the mirror, and all of a sudden it's like, hey, I'm head boy at Hogwarts. Not only that, but look, I'm holding both the house cup and the Quidditch cup because I'm the Quidditch team captain. And it's not until the next day when Professor Dumbledore explains it that they come to understand. Dumbledore says, the mirror shows nothing more or less than the deepest, most desperate desire of our hearts. You, Harry, who've never known your family, see them standing around you. Ronald, who's always been overshadowed by his brothers, sees himself standing alone, the best of all of them. But then Dumbledore warns them. This is what you see in the mirror. He says, but the mirror will give us neither knowledge nor truth. Men have wasted away before it, entranced by what they've seen, or they've been driven mad, not knowing if what it shows is real or even possible. Now, you better get on with real living. Don't waste away in front of this mirror of your desires. If there were such a mirror of Erised, a mirror of desire, and you stood in front of it, what would it show? Would it show you thin and beautiful? Would it show you rich and successful? Would it show you powerful and in charge? If it would show you you, just know that mirror will have the same effect. You will waste away before that which you value and worship most. But here's a beautiful thing. We have a mirror that shows us knowledge and truth. Not just about ourselves, but about that which is most desirable. And if we stand in front of it, we don't waste away. We actually find our souls enlarged. And that mirror is the scriptures themselves. The Bible is called, at a few different places, it's likened metaphorically to a mirror. You look into this word and you not only see an accurate reflection of yourself, but the mirror reveals to you God, the object of truest desire, the treasure really worth treasuring. And this is what Psalm 95 reveals to us in a very short amount of words, very brief statements. It says, look at God. For the Lord is the great God, the great King above all gods. In his hand are the depths of the earth. The mountain peaks belong to him. The sea is his, for he made it. And his hands form the dry land. And he is our God. And we are the people of his pasture, the sheep of his hand. The mirror shows us at very one and the same time, a God who is omnipotent in power and transcendent and higher than all, who holds the earth in his hands, and a God who is imminent and personal and related in covenant love to us. He's our God and we're his people. And the hands that form the universe also hold our hands and guide us along. And oh, worship that God. That's a God worth desiring. That's one worth truly worshiping. And if you will fix your heart, your gaze, and your affections on him, you won't waste away before him. You will grow. You will be enlarged. How do you do this? How do you worship? Which is both a question just for you to consider. How do I worship? But then instructive. Like, how do you worship? Well, let me tell you how from this passage. It's where our bodies get involved. And I want you to see a couple of basic things. First of all, it calls this psalm for full-bodied engagement in worship. Worship is not a mental exercise. Worship is not merely, cognating, good thoughts about God. No, it's about singing for joy. It's about shouting aloud. It's about extolling God with music and song. It's about bowing down. It's about kneeling before him. It takes everything from the ecstasy of singing and shouting to the reverence of kneeling and bowing and says, engage in this. Engage bodily in worship. Now, I love when what the Bible tells us to do, science then goes on and proves that it's good for you. And that's exactly, there is research on worship done by secular researchers. One group at the University of Washington, they studied worshiping congregations, 12 of them. They studied them sociologically and neurologically to find out what is going on when these people worship. And one of the first things they found is that things are going on in their brains that are powerful. You've probably heard of oxytocin. It's the feel-good hormone in your brain. And what researchers found is that few things release oxytocin like worship does. It is one of the great generators of feel-good hormones in your brain. Worship, there is literally a high for you to have, a good one, through worship. Now, researchers say that oxytocin, they sometimes call it the amnestic hormone, as in amnesia, because what oxytocin actually does, they say, is it melts down existing neural connections so that new ones can be formed. It actually releases old thoughts, old ways, old patterns, and generates new thoughts, new ways, new thought patterns. And this is a good thing. This is a very good thing. Some people think, and that's the problem with worship, You're just deluding yourself into a mental state that has nothing to do with reality. But you know what researchers have actually found? Worship's really good for you. Andrew Newberg is a neuroscientist at the University of Pennsylvania. And this is what he says. He goes, first of all, you have in your brains sections that seem designed specifically for spiritual experience. He calls them mystical experiences. You have, for one, the posterior superior parietal lobe. You all know about that, right? I mean, it's kind of at the upper back of your brain. And it seems specifically designed for worship experiences. And this is what Newberg says through his research. Spiritual experience at its very root is intimately interwoven with human biology. Biology, in some ways, compels it. Your brain wants it. Science has not been able to empirically prove that mystical experience is a product of distraught or dysfunctional minds, as much as some people would like to prove that. Rather, significant research, in fact, shows that people who experience genuine mystical states enjoy much higher levels of psychological health than the public at large. Better relationships, higher self-esteem, lower anxiety, clearer self-identity, increased concern for others, and a more positive overall outlook on life. And who would say, I don't need any more of that? No, we would love to have more of that, and it's ours in worship. Now, this is, I think, exactly what the scriptures have prescribed all along. Take, for example, Romans 12, 1 and 2. A couple of sentences the Apostle Paul wrote, very famous. It says, therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual worship. Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you'll be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. Now look at the flow there. You start with your body. You offer your body as a spiritual act of worship, doing the kinds of things that Psalm 95 talks about and other disciplines as well. You start with your body, and this leads to a renewed mind. Your mind begins to be reshaped. It lets go of the patterns of this fallen world, and it latches on to the ways of God. And it leads to you actually knowing by experience, testing and approving the good, pleasing, and perfect will of God. And it starts with your body. This is what the researchers on worship say. They say what you see happening is another physical phenomenon that they call embodied cognition. And get this. We like to think that, you know, typically our brains sort of, we start here and our brains tell us what we're thinking and what we're feeling. But embodied cognition actually says, you know what? It just as often, or actually more so, happens that your body tells your brain what to think and feel. It's kind of like this. Anger is not just an idea, and you get angry in your brain, and therefore you tense up and you furrow your brow and you scowl. No, you tense up and furrow your brow and you scowl, and your brain says, hey, I think he's angry. Joy is not just some feeling in your brain that all of a sudden sort of causes you to relax and smile. No, you relax your muscles, you smile, you adopt a posture of openness, and all of a sudden your brain registers, hey, I think we're happy. I think there's joy going on here. And researchers have actually found that some people are brain damaged in such a way that they can't really kind of make sense of the fact that, say, when they're fearful, suddenly their blood pressure goes up and their hearts race and their breathing gets shallow. Somehow that's happening, but their brains don't perceive that. And you know what? They can't feel fear. You can show them a frightening situation. You know, a man standing before an uncaged tiger. And they can tell you, oh, that's a frightening situation. A person should feel afraid. And yet they can't feel it. Because we have this embodied cognition. It starts with what our bodies are doing and feeling, and then the feeling registers up here, which again says brilliant things about what we can do as we give our bodies to God in worship. Why do I want to give way to hopelessness or despair or despondent feelings when I could put my hope in God and get myself into a better state? The Psalms describe this again and again. Let me give a couple examples. You know, Psalm 42 is a famous psalm where, as the deer pants for streams of living water, so my soul pants for you, my body longs for you. I'm in a dry, parched land, and I need God. And Psalm 42 goes on to say, so why are you downcast, O my soul? I'll tell you why, because you're in a dry, parched land, and you got nothing. Why so disturbed within me? Put your hope in God, for I will yet praise him, my Savior and my God. My soul is downcast within me, therefore I will remember you. It's like, yes, I'm feeling downcast. Circumstantially, this is not the happiest place I've ever been. So what am I going to do? Am I just going to give way to that? No, I'm going to put my hope in God. I'm going to praise God. I'm going to remember God. And it's actually going to bring me into a connection with him and into a connection with a larger reality that says, God's got this. And I have a God who causes all things to work together for the good of those who loved him and are called according to his purpose. I'm going to get my soul happy in God. In Psalm 57, it's penned by David. There's a little note at the beginning of Psalm 57 that says, this was written in a cave when David was on the run from King Saul. King Saul wanted to kill him, so David flees into the wilderness and he's hiding in a cave. And he's lamenting his plight at first. It's like, you know, man, it's like these Saul and his armies, they're like ravenous animals that are hunting me down. And now here I am probably surrounding by ravenous animals. And they're spreading a net before me, trying to entrap me. What am I going to do? Am I just going to despair? David writes, here's what I'm going to do. I will sing and make music. Awake, my soul. Awake, harp and lyre. I will awaken the dawn. I will praise you, Lord, among the nations. I will sing of you among the peoples. For great is your love, reaching to the heavens. Your faithfulness reaches to the skies. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth, not to mention in my own soul. See what David's doing? Yes, his circumstances are not happy. But it's like, why am I going to give way to this? No, I'm going to use worship to awaken my soul. I'm not just going to try to think happier thoughts. This is what so many of we Western rationalists do. It's like, well, I'm just going to try to think better. You know, stinking thinking. I get it. No, do something with your body. Worship God. Form words and pray out loud to God. Lift your hands to God. Play instruments to God. Move your body and you will find embodied cognition at work in you. It's why the psalm calls us to full-bodied engagement. But here's the second facet. Here's the second thing. It calls for full-bodied engagement from all of us. Don't miss kind of the obvious here, that the call to worship here is not for individuals, but it's for the body of believers. Come, let us sing. Let us shout. Let us come before him with thanksgiving. Let us bow. Let us kneel. Hey, personal worship is great, and I'd encourage you to discover the joys of it. But there is nothing like corporate worship together. It produces what the University of Washington researchers said. They call it social euphoria. Social euphoria. It's the same thing you get at a parade or a pep rally or a party. Hey, we're all together doing something and it's cool. And guess what? I sort of feel strong. I sort of feel better. They say social euphoria is a bodily phenomenon, a feeling of confidence. Courage to take action, boldness in taking initiative. Now, sometimes, you know, social euphoria happens in a mob and it moves you to do bad things, you know. All of a sudden you feel strong, you got your beer muscles and you want to fight, you want to shout obscenities, you want to go climb a light pole, you want to flip cars over and set them on fire. But in a worship environment, social euphoria can strengthen all the kingdom values about how we want to love God with our whole hearts. Or love the world that Jesus, through his people, is working to restore. It gives me compassion for the downtrodden, love for my enemy. It makes me want to give generously or serve selflessly. And it happens socially. I like what James K.A. Smith says, a theologian. He says, we are a people whose orientation to God is shaped from the body up more than the head down. We, together, we shape our orientation to God from what our bodies do, first and foremost. Well, here's what ALC says. He says, worship allows us to experience our belief in union with fellow believers, making the content of our belief more meaningful and engaging. Through worship, belief becomes an experienced fact. So how do we worship? Full-bodied engagement together, all of us. Hey, let's just remember, when we come together for church, this is not the stage where the performers do something for the audience. No, when we come together like this, we are a congregation worshiping God together. And can I just for a moment issue the same challenge that I do periodically? I would just invite you, how do you worship? Think about this very personally for you. How do you worship currently? And could you worship better in the future? And by better, I mean something very tangible and physical. Like, I just, for example, what if, like, after this Sunday, everybody just physically moved one row closer? Moved one or two rows closer. Because there's something about the communal experience when we're not too diffused, but we're closer and tighter. That is part of the whole worship phenomenon that we want to know and experience. What if you took, like, your singing voice, no matter how strong or not, and what if you just turned up the volume? Just one or two notches. Turn it up from 3 to 5. If a song calls for it, what if you actually took the risk and said, you know what, I could put a hand in the air. How many times do we sing, we lift up our hands, and we don't lift up our hands? Hey, lift up your hands. Lift up your hands. And don't think about what the people in front of you or beside you or behind you are thinking. You just lift up your hand to God, to the God who loves you and saves you and secures your future. Whatever it would be for you, one more tick ahead in full-bodied congregational engagement. And why would we do this? Why do we worship? Well, we already talked about it. Because God deserves it, for he's a great God. He's the king above all gods. For we are his people, the sheep of his pasture. But there's one other reason to worship. It's not just because God deserves it. It's because we need it. I want to take you to the end of the passage. Did you notice how this psalm was a beautiful psalm, and then all of a sudden the guy like throws in a big bummer at the end? You know, he had a good thing going for two stanzas. Come, let us sing for joy. Verse 2, come, let us bow down. Verse 3, how about one other reason to come and worship God? No, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as you did at Meribah, as you did that day at Massah in the wilderness, where your ancestors tested me. They tried me, though they had seen what I did. And for 40 years I was angry with that generation. I said, they will never enter my rest. Now this is essentially the same kind of a call. Worship God, and there's a reason you need it. We come and we sing and shout. We come and we kneel and bow down. We come and whatever we do, we don't close our hearts. We don't harden our hearts. We don't take a detached kind of spectator attitude here, because God is in our midst and he deserves our engagement. No, we open our hearts. We give him our hearts. We reach out with our hearts, because guess what? There's more of God to be had than we have right now. We can enter into his rest. We can enter into fuller blessing than we've experienced to date. And that's why we worship. The psalmist draws a lesson from Israel's history. It's from the time of the Exodus, right? Moses comes in and God rescues his people from slavery in Egypt. He rains down the 10 plagues. He cuts a path through the Red Sea, and he's going to bring them from the land of slavery to the promised land, a land flowing with milk and honey. But between here and there is a wilderness. They got to cross the Sinai Desert, which is actually a great opportunity for them to further learn to be formed up as people of faith. And God, it says here, they tested God. But they tested God in response to actually a test that God gave them. He brings them into the wilderness, and just briefly, just temporarily, he wants to train these people. He wants to exercise their faith muscles. He wants them to grow as mature, noble, faith-filled, God-worshiping people. So what does he do? He withholds water and food. He's not going to starve them to death out there, but he withholds it. And they're out in the desert, and it happens 3 times. All of a sudden, they're out of water. Now, when you're out of water and you see your children, your elderly are going to begin to suffer, if you see what God had done, 10 plagues, a path through a sea, you might say, you know what? God's got this. He didn't bring us out of Egypt for nothing. We've seen his power. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to gather up and we are going to worship and pray. We are going to exalt the God of heaven, and we're just going to remind him, hey, you know what? You are awesome, and we are not, and we need water. Would you provide us with water, God? We know you can do it because we've seen what you did. Do they do that? No. They grumble. They complain. They accuse God of bringing them into the desert to kill them. And then they turn around and threaten to kill Moses. And you know what? We'll just go back to Egypt and we'll just surrender to our captors. And God's like, are you kidding me? And he gives them water and leads them on a little further. And then he withholds food. Let's see if they'll pass the test this time. We'll retest. Same thing. So he gives them food. They go on a little further. It's like, let's hold back on the water again. Surely the third time they'll get this right. Nope. Same thing. Murderous anger and despondency. And then they go on and spy out the land and they're afraid to go there too. And God's like, forget it. These people will never enter my rest. And instead of like maybe 40 days across the wilderness, it's 40 years. And oh, may we not miss out on the rest of God, the blessing of God. There's more of God to be had than we currently have. And we're going to access it by heartfelt, faith-filled worship. If you don't come to church ready to engage, hey, I'm glad you come to church. But now's the time to repent and aim your affections at heaven. Because you can yet get this thing right. You can yet enter into God's rest and his blessing. It's kind of like this. Let me close with a story. I'm going to steal this from Tim Keller and embellish it a bit. But Keller tells a story of like a woman who inherits from her grandmother a piece of jewelry, a kind of antique brooch. And she receives it from her grandmother's estate when grandma passes away. And she looks at it, it's like, you know, it's kind of big and gaudy and it's not really my style. It's sort of passe, but it does have sentimental value. So of course I'll keep it. And she puts it in her jewelry box. Day in and day out, she wears all different kinds of jewelry, but never that brooch. And over time, it sort of sinks lower and lower to the bottom of the box. And every once in a while, like around the holidays, she's digging a little deeper, looking for something for the holidays, and she'll come across the brooch, but of course she passes over that, and she finds something else. Well, one Christmas, she's looking for something. She's rooting deep down into the jewelry box, and she comes across this brooch. She says, well, you know, it is kind of Christmassy, and at Christmas time, you can sort of get away with some things that you can't the rest of the year. I think I'm going to wear this brooch. And she wears the brooch and she wears it to a party. And lo and behold, she gets a number of compliments on the brooch. In fact, she has a friend with impeccable taste who says, wow, look at that piece. That is something I've never seen before. That is really special. Where did you get it? It's like, oh, it's an heirloom from my grandma. Really? It looks expensive. Have you ever had it appraised? It's like, no, my grandma wasn't rich. I'm sure it's nothing, but it does have sentimental value to me. It's like, I'd get it appraised. I think it's something pretty special. Well, on the word of her friend of impeccable taste, this woman says, oh, why not? Let's take it to a jeweler and see what we have here. And so you take it to the jeweler, and he puts his little jeweler's glass on, and he starts to look at it, and suddenly his face turns white and his jaw drops open and the eyeglass falls down. And he says, ma'am, I don't know if you know what you have here, but this piece comes from an ancient royal dynasty. Every gem in this brooch is real. The silver work is of such craftsmanship and a kind of style and technique that has passed into oblivion. It's not practiced anymore. I can't tell you what this brooch is worth because there is none like it. It is a unique masterpiece. It is priceless. And all of a sudden, the woman feels both supremely blessed and utterly foolish at the same time. This thing is unique, that is holy, and I've been treating it as profane. I've had it tucked away at the bottom of a box somewhere. But I have an opportunity now to do this right. I have a treasure of supreme value. I'm going to honor it as such. I'm going to treat it accordingly. And you see, this is exactly what God is or is to be to us. Hey, maybe your Christian faith is something that you've considered of little account. It's an heirloom from your grandmother. But may God open your eyes and your heart to see his supreme value, the value of his gospel, the value of his one and only son, Jesus, who died for you. And may you mend your ways and recognize you are supremely blessed, but you've been utterly foolish. And you've been counting him of no account. May he rise in your affections. And through worship, may you point your affections to him that you might love him more and more. And enter into the blessing and rest and receive every good promise he's ever made to the children he dearly loves. Well, in a moment, we're going to close with a time of worship. We're going to receive communion together first, the symbols of Jesus' body and blood. And this is part of our embodied worship. We want to take Jesus into ourselves.